With all due respect to March Madness, spring began this morning at precisely 1:49 Eastern Time. That was the moment of the vernal equinox when the sun was directly above the Earth's equator. For weeks now, our reporter Alice Furlow has been on the lookout for the earliest signs of spring from her home on Cape Cod, where winter still has a foothold.
Vivaldi's Violin Concerto La Primavera, or Spring, does not sound like spring where I live on the far tip of Cape Cod. On the first day of March, a few feet from my dangerous, solidly frozen driveway, there was a surprise. The tiny flowers called snowdrops were suddenly out on a cat's grave. They're the first plants to bloom in my scraggly backyard. This is a yearly pre-spring event, which always takes me by surprise. The white flowers are bent over, as if expecting the stormy blast, and so far they've survived three snowstorms and a day of rain and sleet. I asked Robert Prescott, the director of the Wellfleet Wildlife Sanctuary out here, what other signs of spring I should look out for.
You know, there's all sorts of signals for springtime here on the Cape and around the Northeast. Some people who are very optimistic look at spring being the first birds to start nesting, and that's the great horned owl, and it starts nesting in February.
That great horned owl with its huge ears and 5-foot wingspan is a scary bird. When our black and white cat, Brooks, disappeared one spring, an Audubon expert told me a great horned owl might have snatched him up, mistaking him for a skunk, the favorite food of this particular owl. Not one of the harbingers of spring that Vivaldi seems to have had in mind in this joyful concerto. He must have been thinking of his native Italy. So I went north to Cambridge to consult Professor Lino Pertile about the Italian spring. He's Harvard's professor of Romance Languages and Literature, and he received me in his stately library. Professor Pertile turned out to be very tall and craggily handsome, wearing a striped shirt, a tweed vest, and blue jeans. He was born and grew up in a small village near Padua. There, the children celebrated spring on March 1st with a proverb in their local dialect.
Primo di marzo, il matto va scalzo. That is to say, on the 1st of March, the madman goes barefoot. And we, as children, took off our shoes and our socks and used to walk barefoot on the earth, on the soil, on the fields. And I still remember that special feeling that you have when the sun has been shining for a few days and just the surface of the soil gets that little crust, you know, after a few days of sunshine. And you walk over that little crust and you break it with your feet. And it is just simply unforgettable.
Padding around in the mud might not suit these two American first graders, Amber and Sophia. When they came to tea, they mostly wanted to talk about their favorite TV show, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy.
The one that gets the clothes and the one that gets the shoes. It's right before my bedtime.
Amber finally settled down to talk about her favorite spring activity.
Playing on your scooter.
Oh, where do you play on the scooter? On the sidewalk?
I don't, but I want to get a scooter for my birthday. And if I did, then I'd play with it at spring.
Hope springs eternal in the human breast, as Alexander Pope remarked. And spring, in that sense of springing up, is the basis of our word for the season. But what makes the flowers spring up, and squirrels and foxes and raccoons spring out of their burrows and nests, and people spring out of their houses? Robert Prescott explains that all of us respond to the increased sunlight.
We see and feel the difference in some sort of maybe deep-seated portion of our psyche when the days start to get longer after the new year, you know, and the mornings are lighter and the sun is setting later. Suddenly we start to feel a little different. And that's what nature is feeling, that pulse, that change.
And poets especially feel it, don't they? I assumed that Italian poetry would be full of spring flowers, like the gaudy melon flower Robert Browning disliked so much. I asked Harvard's Professor Pertile to read me something about spring in Italian.
De bella donna che raggi d'amore ti scaldi.
He obligingly read a passage from Purgatory in Dante's Divine Comedy, where Dante arrives in the earthly paradise and tells a beautiful woman that she reminds him of the goddess of spring.
E della primavera.
Gosh, I bet Harvard students line up in droves to take Pertile's course, Italian 123, Semantics of Desire, the erotic theme in Dante's poetry. But the professor told me that there are practically no flowers in Italian poetry. The best nature poets by far are English. He says the longing English people have for warmer southern landscapes produces a poetry especially rich in nature descriptions, while Italians in the warm landscapes just don't bother.
I know this might disconcert you a bit, but it is true that if you think about it, we just don't have anyone like Wordsworth in Italian. We just don't. We have some romantic poets.
No daffodils.
No, Italians would be really challenged by mentioning more than the name of three or four different flowers. And this includes the poets, except the poets find special names in vocabularies. Now they use them, but they have no idea what they're talking about.
The professor is right about English nature poets. There are 62 quotations in English for spring, in Bartlett's Familiar Quotations, and 4 for springtime. And even if you leave out references to things springing out at you and springtime for Hitler, more than half are from poetry. And that's not counting the May or June quotations, or the April ones, where, of course, you find Eliot's Cruelest Month and Chaucer's Pilgrims. The song April Showers is included, but not April in Paris. No one should believe that song. April is freezing in Paris. French children recite a jingle which warns, in April, don't take off a stitch of your winter clothes. And it's only March.
There will always be springtime in heaven.
Seeking for signs of improvement in the heavens, I went to the offices of the Elegant Sky and Telescope magazine in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sky and Telescope costs $5.50, but it's in a distant and dingy part of Cambridge, far from Harvard. One of its senior editors is the astrophysicist Alan McRobert. He was tall, blonde, and wearing a Fair Isle sweater, and his attitude was positive.
There may be ice on the ground, but look up in the sky in the evening and you'll see unmistakable promises that spring is here. The Big Dipper is up in the northeastern sky. It's part of Ursa Major, the great bear, coming out of hibernation after winter. Leo the lion, Hydra the sea serpent, are coming up in the eastern sky, and the bright constellations of winter, Orion, Canis Major, the big dog, are all heading down, marching away into the sunset in the west.
I'll gaze at the stars when it gets warmer. But in my backyard, the only sign of spring is still that little cluster of hopeful-looking snowdrops. Early spring is all about hope. And the very word hope makes me remember a month I spent alone in a primitive Swiss chalet on the cold and shady, uninhabited side of a mountain. I'd been in a state of anxiety and sadness for a long time, and there were faint signs that all might yet be well. On an ugly old wardrobe, I scotch-taped a verse from Swinburne's poem Atalanta. Every day I read it aloud as a sort of lucky charm. It worked. Here it is. For winter's rains and ruins are over, and all the season of snows and sins, the days dividing lover and lover, the light that loses, the night that wins, and time remembered is grief forgotten, and frosts are slain and flowers begotten, and in green underwood and cover, blossom by blossom, the spring begins. For NPR News, I'm Alice Furlow on Cape Cod.
It's spring again, and birds on the wing again start to sing again the old melody. I love you, that's the song of songs, and it all belongs to you and me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.